Hello and welcome to this special episode of Papierstau Podcast. I'm Maike and today I have the pleasure to talk to the wonderful Paitim Statovci. Paitim has published 4 novels, all of which have been acclaimed by critics and readers around the world. His debut, My Cat Yugoslavia, won the International Literature Award and 2 of his novels were awarded the Finlandia Prize, which is probably Finland's most prestigious literary honor. One of them is Bola, the book that will be the focus of our conversation. The Yugoslav Wars, the search for identity and belonging, crossing different kinds of borders. These themes are central to Paitim's work. He was born in Kosovo to Albanian parents and his family fled to Finland when he was only 2 years old. With his psychologically complex texts, full of folkloristic and mythological allusions, he has made a name for himself far beyond Finland's borders. Welcome to the show, Paitim Statovci. So first, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We have 2 excellent German writers. We're proud to have them, Tian Zila and Sasha Stanicic, who wrote great novels about the war in Yugoslavia and their childhood experiences. And in Bola, we have Arsim and Miloš, and they are torn apart by this very war. As a child, you had to flee this war. How was Bola inspired by your own experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in a rather small city in Kosovo. It was about 5 kilometers away from the Serbian border. And I was a toddler when my family sought refuge here in Finland. So I have no memories of life before Finland. And I was raised in a very traditional Albanian family here in Finland, in a Swedish-speaking city. And I attended Finnish schools and I spoke Albanian when I was at home. So I think it's fair to say that all of this has, in a way, broken my identity into many different pieces. And to be honest, I don't know if I trust that it'll ever be the other way. When you grow up in the middle of number of different languages, religions, cultures, people who are very different from one another, none of them necessarily feel your own. So I like to say that I consider myself a local in various different places and countries and fluent in a number of different surroundings. However, you know, I'm sure that Stanisic and Sheila have also spoken about this, that often when you're writing from the minority, you're often pinned down by other people as a representative of that certain minority. And also your work is seen as a representative act. You know, I keep seeing these headlines sometimes in the media here in Finland that I am the voice of the immigrant generation of Finland, although I didn't sign up for this role, but because of my background, this keeps happening. And I've always thought to myself, you know, when I'm referred as an Albanian or as a voice of a generation or a country, it amuses me because how come all these people, you know all of that about me when my identity is still a mystery to myself as well? So the idea of like a clear national, sexual or ethnic or any identity at all, it doesn't really sit that well with some of the artistic goals that I have and some of the premises of my work. Before answering your question, I guess I'm trying to say that I'm not sure if there's an identity, you know, for every one of us. But throughout my upbringing, I have lived in rather strict environments and seen and experienced and witnessed downfalls of people like Arsim, people who are not that connected to their emotions, not able to separate the right from wrong, the good from evil, because they carry so much trauma, and war has drawn new lines between what's seen morally correct and what is seen right and what is seen bad and good. So For personal reasons, also my entire like body of work is an extension of my personal story. In this book, I needed to step outside my comfort zone also and attempt to understand a mind like Arsim's. Why is he so shattered? Why is he so broken that he's unable to make the correct, the good decision for himself, for his family? I had to disregard some rules of writing altogether. For example, having a narrator or a main protagonist that you want to root for, because he's quite unlikable in many ways in the books. And so I needed to travel with this person into the darkness. And it was an attempt to see him more clearly and also maybe give it a shot at forgiveness too, because I had this urge to investigate what has driven this man in this situation, in this position, to become so lost and desperate. And I believe that we as human beings, we are, especially if the circumstances are extreme, we are capable of unmeasurable evil, but also acts of utmost love. And this friction, interests me on a psychological level. And with writing fiction, the fictional territory is such a good place to, and a safe place to crash these. I tend to say, so this answer is so long to your
Doesn't
question,
matter, it's
but
very
it's yeah,
interesting.
it's all related. But I tend to say that I write about the world the way I have seen and experienced it, and I write about people and subjects and places that are meaningful to me in a personal way. And this hasn't changed over the course of my writing career. I've been a writer for over 10 years now. And some might consider this way of seeing the world rather brutal or violent or one-sided or unforgiving, but it doesn't change this fact. I write about what is close to me. But this being said, I don't consider my writing a representative act either, but I also understand that I don't write in a cocoon. I try and want to avoid writing under any kind of burden or expectation of time and place or pressure, because it always manages to diminish the sense of freedom I need to be able to write altogether, the sense of freedom that my characters also need to exist without them having their own right to define themselves. I, as well as my characters, I feel like I need to exist outside the normative world to be alive in a way. I hope this all makes sense in a way, but it's a difficult question really, because I wouldn't be here without my personal history, without my personal story. These books wouldn't be available without that. But then,
But maybe that's the beauty, because it sounds like even to yourself, it's an enigma how you create these stories and how exactly they are connected to you and your subconscious, because yeah, just bigger than just a representation of what you are or what you experience. You create something much bigger than that. And maybe sometimes it sounds like even outside of your own reach. And I think that's beautiful. And I also understand that if you're an artist, especially in a mediaized world where everything is multiplied in pictures and interview and everything, people probably try to project their ideas on you according to what you said or the pictures of you. But that's, of course, just a projection and representation, but it's not you.
Exactly. I think you're very right when you say that. I think writing in general is it's very dissociative in a way. Even the writing act to me has always felt like I've entered this different realm, this mindset of someone that is not myself, this narrator, this mind that lives in a different time and place than I do. And for me, when I write my books, it feels like I transmute into a wholly different existence, or it's as if I have another consciousness available to me at the same
That
time
sounds amazing.
as my consciousness, like in this reality. But then I also feel like it extends the dissociativeness of writing. It extends outside the writing itself, in the publication of the novel, people might have certain depictions and ideas of what you write about, and certain they project, as you say, certain identities or expectations to you, and that's not necessarily,
That congruent with who you are. What we loved on the podcast, because we discussed My Cat Yugoslavia and Crossings, and what we loved is, and you just mentioned that as well, how you, that's how we've read it at least, how you deconstruct identity and how you show borders as something that can be dangerous, but also as something that can be liberating because the border exists and this opens the space for you to cross it. And that can be liberating and it can be strengthening and it can set you free. And you also just said that we are not, as people, cannot be compartmentalized in certain gender identity or nationalities, but that we are very complex and maybe cannot even fathom ourselves what we are really made of, what our consciousness is made of. And I think that is also the case in Bola, where you have those two really complex protagonists. They are haunted by their love, loss, the war, trauma, homophobia, the migration experience, fear. It's really impressive how you manage to convey those really complex psychological issues. How do you go about creating such characters and showing this degree of psychological depth?
I love this question. Please bear with me because I expect that my response will be elaborate. But as you say, I think that we go through a number of different identities during our life. We have different roles in different surroundings, and I think that this applies to like all identities an individual might have: a national identity, the spiritual one, gender identity. With my work, with my entire body of work, I like to celebrate this freedom of self-expression. Every individual has the right to define themselves in the relation to their surroundings, the way they see fit, and all identifications are valid. And an individual also has the right to change their mind. So this fluidity, this refusal of self-definition is very present in all of my books. For example, in Crossing that you mentioned, it's rather obvious because the protagonist in Crossing is very aware of the identity politics, and it becomes like a game for the narrator. The narrator keeps telling stories that the narrator thinks other people want to hear to get ahead in life, to get into a better position. So they have learned this skill to manipulate other people by changing their own position in life. But in Bola, this is more like seen under the surface because the protagonist, Arsim, he never really manages to grab hold of his emotions and look at himself in the mirror and accept that he is living his life as a closeted homosexual. There's no language or that backs him up, no cultural setting, no, he has no examples in life for an existence like his. There's no room for this kind of awareness in his head because he just doesn't have the luxury of living in a world of acceptance. And I think it's important to write stories of those, who don't have this luxury. Those who don't make it, those who don't grow to be anything, those who, get hurt and never heal, those who, remain bitter and sad until the very end of their lives. Because I think that life often ends without, the dreams coming true. There's not necessarily an atonement or a catharsis or healing that comes with suffering and trauma. Sometimes it just weakens and makes us pathetic and more sad and more resentful. And it feels more true because, like the Kosovo War, for example, has wounded people in so many ways for so many generations that the sad stories feel more real than the happy stories. There's more sadness that has come along with that than there's happiness. But then maybe it's written into us that we expect the stories that we tell each other to end up in an inspirational or a motivational or a happy note. And maybe in my writing, I'm trying to like go against that a little bit because I just don't feel that it's a good reflection of real life. So to answer your question more directly, I thought a lot about the themes you mentioned in your questions when I was writing this book. I was also thinking a lot about forgiveness and redemption that are also a crucial aspect in this novel. You know, how we are often expected to forgive the people who do us wrong, you know, how forgiveness is seen as something almost prerequisite for us to be able to move on. It's sometimes it's even demanded from those people who suffer some kind of oppression. But I think that this demand can also be kind of reductive and very dismissive too, because the victim is often expected to forgive, and the oppressor is often the one who gets to be set free, and the oppressor gets to move on, but the victim is left with the pain and the trauma. And I find it a bit backwards to say to someone that, well, if you are unable to forgive something bad that has happened to you, you will only hurt yourself, and you will only build a wall between you and other people, and you will not heal the way you are supposed to. But I don't know. Maybe we are supposed to be resentful and become angry and not forgive each other, you know, many things.
It relates to the whole discussion of who gets to be an acceptable victim, that people are only granted to be resentful or in pain or angry if they fulfill a certain image of what a victim is supposed to be, which is in itself a form of victimization.
Exactly. It's such a like a Christian way to see it. Like, is forgiveness like a virtue, really? Especially if it's a forced forgiveness, or if you do it just because you believe that you do it for selfish reason. Because if to forgive is the only way to move forward from something, then you are not doing it for the right reasons. Maybe it's a selfish reason in the end, you know, to get over it. But it's an important and a good question. Like, why do you have to forgive those who have done you wrong, like free of charge?
It also relates to what you said before, that that your novel doesn't have heroes in a sense that there are people that you root for because they are good, just good. And I feel like it's a good trend that novels now focus more strongly on characters that are not relatable and not figures of identification. Because why do I read a novel? I don't want to see myself in every character. I don't want to be friends with every character. I mean, it can be a challenge and it can be interesting to see the world from another perspective. I don't have to agree. It just widens my horizon just to take another stance.
And so I completely agree with you. And actually, I don't know if you know this, but I published a fourth novel in Finland last year
I heard
called
about that.
Called A Cow Gives Birth at Night. And like the main question in the novel is like, is it all right to revenge at least sometimes? And is it all right to feel good after you have gotten your vengeance? And these thoughts like plagued me for years before starting this novel. But it's about the concept of revenge, but let's not go into that now. But the way I see it, holding a grudge and not forgiving can also be something that gives you stamina and strength, you know, because living under the belief that one day you will get the like, one day karma will find the people who do you wrong, and one day you will be the one who's standing last and able to laugh. This can sometimes get you motivated and inspirated to move towards, you know, something, you know, the spitefulness, it can lead to a growth of the inner strength, in my opinion.
When will we get a translation? Is there a date for the English or the German translation
I
already?
mean, the rights have sold to Germany. I think that English translation is going to be in early 2027 or late 2026.
What? Okay.
Yeah, like
It's too
next
long. They
year.
should translate faster. No,
Yeah,
it's
it's usually it
fascinating.
usually takes around 2 years at least for the first translation from the original.
It's
But yeah.
fascinating. Everything that you say also re relates to a discourse we have here about literature, about the Yugoslavian wars, because Tijan Zila, who lives 20 minutes from me, we are very proud of him around here because he's so successful. He won a major literary prize with a short text about his parents and how the war destroyed his parents and how angry it made him. And I think these are important texts because there's no happy ending, and it's a reality that he turned into fiction and kind of tried to deal with the fact that his innocent parents were victimized by this war and never overcame it, and he has to carry the trauma as well. And this is a really strong story. So that relates to the theory that you just described. But I also want
Yeah,
to.
it is in a way like a balancing act when you have a narrator like this, and when there's characters who don't act in a morally acceptable way. And when I was writing this book, it turned really quickly into this balancing act, and I was constantly like debating with myself, like how much is too much? Do these depictions of violence go too far? How can I go about with, the character development without losing the readers from the protagonist's side if he keeps doing all these things that causes the reader not to feel empathy toward this person? But this book grew into this moral exploration in the end, and I wanted to like attached to this complex feeling of being stuck, what happens when you're forced to live a life that doesn't feel your own? Where do you go if you don't feel at ease or at home anywhere? That is why all the scenes in which Arsim is his true self are in very claustrophobic environments, such as a prison cell or a small apartment in Pristina or in a car, or on a balcony where he's smoking cigarettes. So it's all very like enclosed. But if you have to live a life that you don't want, can anything like human remain? And this is the question that I hope that the reader could relate most in, because I find that in life in general, sometimes I think that how much of everything that we do, what you do, what I do, what our friends and family do is out of expectation and not of desire. And this book doesn't necessarily answers any of these questions, but asking them is equally important, especially in the queer community that faces a lot of violence and heartbreak and distress in today's world.
Another really important aspect that I wanted to mention is mythology or folklore. I don't know what term you would use, because in my cat Yugoslavia, we have this amazing metaphor, or many metaphors of animals. We really love that about the novel. And here we have Dibola. And of course, I freely admit that I'm super ignorant about folklore in general, even German folklore. So I Googled it and I found out it's some kind of demonic serpent in Albanian mythology. And it opens its eyes once a year and devours every human it sees. How did Dibola make it into your novel?
Yeah, I mean, this is also a long answer. I apologize in advance,
It's fine.
but this is yes, the Bola is this demonic creature in the Albanian mythology. It's a serpent, a sort of serpent. The legend, at least a variation of the legend, has it that it becomes this fire-breathing, winged, multi-headed creature, this dragon, once a year for just one single day when it's set free by the devil. And on that day, it's not called a bola, it's called a kulshedra. And during this day, it ruthlessly kills everyone in sight, causing panic. And for all of the other days, it remains hiding this creature, waiting for its chance to reappear. However, this word, Bola, has other meanings too, depending on who you ask and where you ask. And even my own family didn't see eye to eye with what this creature is. And I think that's a part of the mystery of it. But when I was a child, I was told a lot of stories, a lot of traditional Albanian stories from the mythology and the folklore. And I grew up being very, very afraid of snakes. It was a phobia of mine, actually, for a really long time. And afraid of this creature in particular, because I thought that it was the most messed up thing ever. Can you imagine a snake turning into a more vicious creature than a snake, you know, into a dragon that has wings and can breathe fire. So, in these stories, there was a lot of death and darkness, and they always came with a warning, such as you should never look at Ebola in the eyes because you would become permanently blind, or you would become a statue, or you would lose a limb of yours, or become paralyzed. And I remember always being so intrigued and fascinated by this snake, by this creature, that there's also a drawing of this creature on the last page of the book. I don't know if you have seen it, but it's a replica of an actual picture I drew when I was a child of the Kulshedra rising from in between the mountains. But in this book, I wanted to reinterpret and recreate some of the eerie and the ominous horror stories I heard of it as a child. I wanted to explore if there's something more behind this creature, whether it's misunderstood or misrepresented in some way. So this creature has a metaphorical meaning, as the story is about people who spend their entire lives being afraid and hiding. Arsim, in a way, is hiding from the world, never comes to terms with who he is. Miloš is also a mystery. The reader doesn't know how much of his story that is present only in these journal entries is true or not. And also, Arsim has the power to choose what he reads from the journal when he gets the journal in his hand. In the end, the reader doesn't know if there's more to his story, whether he has fabricated everything. Oyshe, also, I'm spoiling the book here a little bit, but she also decides to remain in the darkness despite being aware of his husband's double life. They all choose to close the door and not open it. They choose to remain inside the mountain where the Bola resides. And very much like the Bola, they don't want to come out. It's enough for them to have that one single day of light and one single day of happiness. So the backstory of the Bola becomes a metaphor for the novel's characters' internal struggle, the war, the lost happiness, living in secret and living in fear. And it also asks a question: if you are allowed to shine or be free for just one day a year, or in the case of Arsim and Milos, to be happy for just one summer, can that be enough light for a lifetime? You know? Because many people have asked me, why does Arsim do this horrible thing in the end of the book? And to me, the answer is very clear. It's because he doesn't want to break the perfection of the memory by living in these terrible circumstances with a sick person. He breaks it because that's all he has, you know. That one brief summer full of sunshine and light is the only thing that he has, and that is what keeps him going, keeps him moving. But I mean, the question was about folklore, and what draws me to it is the symbolic and cultural value in folklore. Folklore's tales and myths are usually told for a significant reason, and they are shaped like that for an important reasons. They legends like these, they live through times and they forever pierce different cultures and communities, and there's something almost like supernatural in their universal nature because they endure so much. And through folklore, I think we can tell something
more true and more valuable than what nonfiction, for example, can tell us.
I have one more really important question to ask. Very important. We are always mesmerized by your language. It's often almost like poetry. What inspires you to write like that? Is it other texts? Is it poetry? Or is it maybe even the sound of the other languages you speak? How does it come about that your fiction sounds like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a very intuitive writer. I don't force myself to ever write. I have to have this certain mindset for me to be able to do it. And sometimes I don't write anything for weeks and weeks, even months. I just go through different materials and but I'm very particular with the language because it might take me quite a long time to find a suitable metaphor for a certain section in the novel. My writing is very associative too, in a way that when I start like finding ways of expression, I do seek support from the languages that I speak and know, from Finnish, English, Swedish, Albanian. I read a lot and all the time. In the university, I studied and enjoyed English and German modernist literature, but however, I do read a lot and all the time, and there are tens of even hundreds of writers that I admire that have inspired me throughout my career, starting from Thomas Mann to Toni Morrison and Sally Rooney, from Franz Kafka to Olga Tokarczuk, Bernard Schlink, Annie Ernaux, Han Kang. Really, there are so many writers and too little time for all of us writers to really get familiarized with all our inspirations, but I get inspired by other writers and artists, from painters, musicians, actors, the opera. I always know how to expect this question, and I am equally unprepared for it.
I totally understand. I'm always mesmerized when people are asked what their favorite book is and they have an answer. I could never answer that question. There is just so much good stuff out there that that you have to love as a reader. So I love to hear this eclectic collection that you just mentioned, even with different media, not just literature.
Yeah, I mean, I just read Samantha Harvey's
Orbital.
Oh my God, what an insightful, the narration was just exquisite. I just love the composition of this novel. Like, what a pearl. As you say, there's just so much inspirational writing out there, so many inspirational writers. It's impossible to choose less than 100, less than 1,000 even.
I have one more really, really important question because throughout the interview, we sometimes heard your dog in the background, and we are great dog lovers in our podcast.
Yes.
We have a dachshund, a pinscher mix, and a terrier. What kind of dog do you have?
I have a whippet.
Oh, how cool!
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel like it's my soul companion.
Same here with my dog.
Magical, you know, the relationship that you build with your animal. You have to rely on like foreign territory, a language that is not familiar to either one of you. And they teach us so much about life, about living in the moment, about rooting yourself and seeing what's, you know, crucial and important in a way. I feel so lucky and so privileged to have a relationship like this with my dog, and it's the best thing ever.
I understand. It's always great to talk to other dog lovers, but I know that you now have to take your dog out.
Yes.
So I'm thanking you so much for
Thank
this
you.
really fun interview. And I hope we're going to talk again soon about your next novel.
I hope so too.